Welcome to the Donna Sebo Show. Donna is an international mental practitioner, award-winning author, counselor, speaker, teacher, and radio TV personality. Dedicated to empowering others through her mental skills, she also features authors and experts from all over the world to share their knowledge and experience with you, the listening audience. Now, let's join Donna and her guests. Here's Donna.
Hello, and welcome. Welcome to an hour of mind power. The power of the mind is a phenomenal thing. How we use it, how we deal with situations in everyday life, it really enables us to have that sense of being able to have dominion in some way over what may seemingly be absolutely ugly. And my guest today, Elliot Race, is a man who has put out a book. It's a memoir. They say it's an autobiography, Stealing the Borders. And this is a man who has an incredible background. And his story, I think you will find, is an interesting one because of the fact that your attitude can make a great deal of difference in how you can survive sometimes the most difficult of times. Elliot, welcome to the show.
Hi, Donna. Hi.
Now, you are a man. You have been involved with IBM's Advanced Systems Development Division. You've taught at universities. You've built your own businesses. You've been involved in designing and building homes. You've got a number of patents to your credit. You are a man that seems to really have a zest for life. Yet, you had experiences with so much of life that was not so pleasant. It was not so wonderful. How is it that you think that you developed what I would call an optimistic or an adventuresome, maybe that's a better word, a curiosity, this adventuresome side of yourself? So many others didn't have that. How did you end up with it?
I think part of it might be the fact that when you're not provided many things, you really learn to generate things on your own through your mind. When you're not given many toys that are self-completing or do everything for you, the battery does the rest of it for you. It doesn't necessarily do very much for your own imagination. So sometimes being deprived and having very little coming at you prepared and ready, I think can be helpful, actually. I sort of make a case somewhere in my book about the almost disadvantages of privilege, because we're so privileged, so much is provided for us, it doesn't provide for the greatest growth.
I think that's very true. In your environment, you are a man that's inventive, you are a man that has acquired a very, very fine education. So many people today feel as if they are entitled. And yet I have found through life that those that have that kind of an attitude are really crippled because, just as you've said, their inventiveness, that drive to step forward, is so suppressed that when they have an opportunity, they literally ignore it because they can't recognize it. And yet you, who have gone through so many experiences in your life, have decided to have a much different life. You said, okay, times were tough, but let's get going. And I really think many times that people, when they have extremely difficult times, especially when they're young, they can develop this resiliency and adaptability, which you very, very clearly demonstrated. Now, in 1947, you were born in 1940.
Yes.
1947, you're 7 years old. You are in the middle of a DP camp in Germany. Tell my audience what a DP camp is or was, and how did that affect you?
Well, a DP camp, some people get confused about that, and they sometimes express their sentiments for the horrors that I lived. And a DP camp is not a concentration camp. It is not what we think of in World War II. A DP stands for Displaced Persons Camp. And what happened after the war, after Hitler was conquered, the Allies, the United States, France, and other countries came in and they established centers where people who basically had been tossed around during the war could stay for a while. It was sort of a resting station until you figured out where you can go. Can you return to your old country? Are you welcome anywhere? So many people, this was right after the war, actually 1945, Donna, when the war ended, is when we got out of Russia at that time and went to Germany. And that's the other thing. People ask, well, how could you go to Germany? Was it safe? And I said, well, yeah, after the war, it was quite safe. It was occupied by the Americans and by the other allies. And in these camps, people went there and they were provided with basic survival needs. So food was provided. You had a measure of shelter. It wasn't known for the previous 5-6 years. Nobody was shooting at you. Nobody was determined to make you extinct. So there was safety. And in that environment, of course, other people were basically concerned with where they're going next. And people dispersed. Some people went to South America, some to Israel. The U.S. was sort of the gold standard. If you could get in here, this was considered a very good thing. But the thing is that the United States did not really open its doors completely. Every year, it would go to Congress, and they would basically vote on how many people from various nationalities they would admit that year. So when you got to DP camp, one of the things you did is get on a list to come to America, on a waiting list. And the things that helped you is if you had very close relatives here, mm-hmm. If you had a brother here or parents here or something, that was very good because you had a sponsor. Because one of the things that the our government here looked for was they were very concerned about people coming here and becoming dependent on our social system because mm-hmm. these are people basically had lost all their means and so on. So they wanted someone to sponsor you, and the sponsor undertook the responsibility for you, basically. If you needed something, or if you were indigent, they signed up to really take care of you. So strangers would not do that. It was basically took family members. We didn't have very close family members here. We had something like a second or a third cousin of my father's. So that did not put us on top of the list. So we were in mm-hmm. Germany for quite a long time.
Now, what I was going to say is, in your book, you describe the different phases of your life. And, of course, many people who have read your material talked about your sense of humor. And one of the points that I'll bring up in just a moment was that you really didn't have any schooling until you were 16 years of age because of the war and being bounced around. But one of the chapters I wanted to talk about, because of being Jewish, that there was this tradition of circumcision. And you go through that, and you make a comment, and you said, this is a crude comment. The lesson I learned was if you let him, your fellow man will cut off your ball. Furthermore, even the people who love you most, like your parents, can be duped into acquiescence in the name of religion or patriotism or something. And I thought, boy, to have that awareness come to you at that age, young, very, very young, and that chapter relating to the whole incident, really, really something, because every culture, I don't care what it is, has their particular paradigm. And a lot of people just stick with it because they say, well, grandfather did it for 2,000 years or whatever, then that's what I'm going to do. And you just had a real wake-up with that, didn't you?
Yeah, I became cynical at a very young age, not always to my advantage. But I was in a position, up to that point, it was sort of a blurry. All we did is run and hide and hide in forests, hide in people's basements and so on. And I was, of course, very young, so I wasn't privy to observing life very much. At the age of 5, 6, 7 in a DP camp, I had a lot of leisure. I mean, I wasn't going to school, and I was observing, and I just saw things around me. And what I saw, what I picked up on, was the hypocrisy. Now, I'm not suggesting all religious is a critic. It's not. But I happened to be in a vantage point where I observed some of the hypocrisy. And at a young age, and rebelled against it, and basically really rebelled against religion as well. But the circumcision thing, it was one of those things where once we were settled. Now, I wasn't circumcised. Normally, Jewish people are circumcised the first week after birth. Now, during the war, my parents had no interest in doing that for a few reasons. One, I was born in the forest, so I wasn't born in the hospital. Second, nobody in their right mind wanted to do something to identify yourself as being Jewish when the agenda was to exterminate Jews. So my parents, for my safety, certainly didn't want to circumcise me. They didn't know if at one point they'd hand me over to a non-Jewish family or something so I could survive, and so they didn't want to circumcise me. In the DP camp, when there was some measure of safety again, the issue came up, because then they turned again to their customs, and that's basically all they had then, lost everything else, so they went back to their customs. And I didn't agree with all of them, so I rebelled at a young age.
Yes, you did.
I write about it, sort of my awareness, that I was different. It occurred at a public bath. We took communal baths over there, and at the age of 7, I suddenly became aware that I was configured a little bit different than the others, and that was, of course, because I wasn't circumcised, and I pressed my parents for an explanation. Clearly, every child wants to fit in. I wanted to be like my father, like my uncles, like everybody else. So I protested. I said, "What is this? Why am I different? Why is everybody different?" And they said, "Well, Jewish people do this." And I was a young child. I said, "Well, aren't I Jewish? What's the deal over here?" And I kind of pushed them into reconsidering it. And I sort of saw it as a party. I knew that circumcisions were a party in the DP camp, and I pressed for a party. I didn't realize it was a surgery that went along with it. So
that's an eye-opener.
And they didn't explain to me. And of course, when I saw the man that does the operation, they call Moyle, he does circumcision. When he showed up in my house and not with the greatest tact, pulled me over to the corner and wanted to examine my genitals, I guess to see what was the fitting instrument to use in this case and so on. And he's examining me, and I saw these clippers and knives and pliers and things. And I made the connection. I said, "Wait, this party is not going the way I wanted. This guy has something. They're not going to do very pleasant things to me." And I sort of ran off, and they all had to hold me down and do it. And that was a very great sense of deception, that they didn't really explain to me, saying, "Well, you sure you want to do this? It's also going to be a surgery, blah, blah, blah. Oh, sure, we'll give you ice cream after the deal." But they didn't tell me anything until I woke up with a lot of pain for a few weeks,
You learned a lot of lessons of self-reliance, and you said that at a very early age, you realized that you had to take care of yourself, regardless of the loving people that you had in your family, that you really had to be aware that you had to take care of you. You had to be responsible for what you did, and that you said children and adults lived together, confronted life and death together. There was no such thing as a babysitter. That presents a whole different perspective than a lot of people could even imagine. today because of the world that they live in. Now, I would imagine people in third world countries would have an understanding of this, more so than, let's say, in the average American household. Now, one of the gifts that you had was a very vivid imagination, and you said that was a key ingredient in your life, and that whatever you had, it came patent. Nothing came with instructions. You were able to make it up as you went along, and that is the wonderful thing about imagination. It can be cultivated, it can be developed, and it really makes such a difference in a person's life, and that's part of what happens in your story about your life, sealing the borders. You go through a lot of things that enabled you to be the person that you are today, enabled you to realize that you could break paradigms, that maybe your family, members of your family couldn't break because they were so entrenched in them. But you were given all of these opportunities to learn and to observe and to grow, and that's exactly what you did. You said the bulk of your education came from the streets, the camps, the bazaars, trains, and occasional movies that which you were able to see. And
Hello?
Yes, can you hear me?
Oh, I thought we lost you, yeah. A lot of my education came that way, and a lot of my formation, yeah. You learn a lot from really being engaged, and also as a child, from being engaged with adults. And that's kind of unfortunate, because in affluent societies, children are very removed from adults. They're another. They have their own bedroom, their own TV, their own tutors, and their own camps, and they don't really learn sort of life things. Now, when I say the bulk of my education came that way, yeah, up to a point, my professional education did not come that way. That became out of tremendous dedication and study at some point. And I also want to correct something. I know it says I had no schooling till the age of 16. That's not completely accurate. I had absolutely no schooling till the age of 12, when I came to this country. Up to that point, I didn't know the alphabet in any language. So all I could do was speak Yiddish at the time, and some smatterings of Azerbaijani or Russian or places that we had passed when I was a child. So being totally illiterate, not being able to read or write in any language, that was till about the age of 12. But I was still functionally illiterate till about 16. I'll tell you what I mean by that. I came here, and because of my age, at the age of 12, they would not put me into the first grade, of course. But they did put me into the sixth grade, and they put me into a section that was really for more challenged students. So I was in the sixth grade with challenged students, which was probably a reasonable thing to do at the time. And somebody would sit in the back. They would choose the better of the students in class to sit with me in the back of the room and go through a reader or something, and just kind of, because I couldn't keep up with that class, I didn't know the language or anything else. And so basically the first 2 years or so was more about just learning how to read, basic reading, something to get up to the level of reading like a second grader. Something like that. By the time I was in the seventh grade, I probably read like a second grader. So at that point, I wasn't totally literate in the sense that I could read and write, albeit I wrote very poorly and read very, very little, you know, something in a comic book or something, certainly not the age where I could read a newspaper or anything else or a book. So I really wasn't growing intellectually at all. So it took another few years here till I was about 16, when I was able to sort of struggle through a whole book, and I think it was Tom Sawyer. So I read the first book when I was 16, and having reached the ability where I could sort of read a book and with a dictionary even understand most of the words, that was the beginning of real literacy. So that's where the 16 comes in, the age 16, rather, Donna.
Now, one of the things that did happen is that when you were in school, something that you noticed is that the class that you had been put in, the students that were there were not performing up to par, and the teacher didn't expect them to. And I thought that that was a very profound observation. Also, you ended up needing glasses. This is something, too, that had to that had an impact on you. And I could relate to that because I got my first pair of glasses when I was in the sixth grade. I had no idea I couldn't see well. And it really had a major effect on what I did in school. So I can relate to that particular situation. But I really loved a lesson that your dad taught you. And he fussed at you one day, and I really appreciated this. And he was very frustrated with you because there was someone that was talking to your dad, and you just thought this person was an utter idiot. And your father, after this person left, said, "Why can't you just stand still and listen?" And you said, "Dad, the man's stupid. Why should I have to listen to him?" And he's responded, "Because you'll learn something." And then your response was, "What can I learn from a stupid man?" Your dad said, "You can learn something from everybody, even from a stupid man," was your question. And his response was, "Yes, son, from anybody. Son, even a broken watch is correct twice a day." I love that story. I just think that is so true. And that is a very typical pattern for, my goodness, not just kids. I've known it to be that way with adults. They'll just make a judgment. This is stupid. And they walk away without taking the time to really hear what's going on. So these lessons that you share are just absolutely wonderful. And you did end up becoming an exceptional student, and you ended up going on to study physics. You decided you wanted, because of a good teacher, you just thoroughly thrived in this environment of learning. It's like a part of you just came alive.
Yeah, you know, I'm almost afraid to get started on the educational system and education in general, but maybe a little bit. You know, in this country, and maybe it's happening more in the rest of the world as well, but education is can be seen, it can be fun, actually. It can be a lot of fun once you kind of get the idea of it. What we do here is we value vegging out. We have expressions like, "I'm just vegging out," or, "Oh, I'm just going to a mindless movie," as if that's like a great thing. You get nothing from it. And we have tremendous respect for sports and sports leaders and so on, and I'm not suggesting we shouldn't. They do some incredible things. But our values as a society are there, and education is so low down in the polls, in the priorities, and we wonder why our educational system is poor, and then we pour money into it, and more classrooms, and better and smaller classes, and fancier schools. And I don't think that means a thing, because we see people in the third world studying, sitting behind a tree where they don't have a classroom. They just get out there when the weather is decent. Mm-hmm. And writing with a chalk in the sand, or with scribbling on something, where they don't have tools, and we are something like on the list of our school system, something like 35 down the list behind people in cultures where they don't have shoes. So it's not the money you pour into it; it's what value are we assigning to the idea of being educated, of being literate. And why does it rank so much lower than who's on a particular game in a baseball team? And that's the problem with this country, and it's a shame.
Well, I concur, and I think one of the things, I've known some very, very fine teachers that really have a passion for teaching their students. And those that do, it plants a seed in students that sometimes takes a while for it to sprout and grow. But the love of learning, the love of exploration, venturing into new worlds, mentoring with people that have knowledge, education, and experience there are so many levels to it. It's not just one level. You just don't memorize something. It's integrating knowledge and education so that it is something that actually makes you a better citizen within a society. But more than that, it should encourage you to think. It should encourage you to explore. It should encourage you to have the adventuresome spirit like you have so often demonstrated in your life. And one of your stories in here I just loved. And it was when you gift-wrapped your trash. That I've never heard anybody else do. And I just, I thought that was so funny. Tell about how it was that you ended up gift-wrapping your trash and leaving it out for other people to collect.
Well, I have to tell you, as an adult, I can't say I'm totally proud now of having done that, but I will tell the story. At the time, I was already an adult. After I worked at IBM, I moved back to Manhattan and got my first apartment. And the apartment was one that needed work. I received a very favorable terms for this apartment, but it really needed a lot of work. And I was up to it. I tend to be handy, and I can do many of the skills on my own. So I renovated the apartment, and then as part of renovation, you generate a lot of debris. And when I went to dispose it, I sort of the way I would dispose of the organic things, garbage, you know, I just put it aside. The superintendent came over and admonished me for it. He said, no, you can't. I said, well, what do you do with it? Why can't I throw out the garbage? And he said, well, yes, you can throw out garbage. You can't throw out debris or construction materials. And you have to hire or rent a dumpster or something like that. And I didn't take that advice very well, and I thought of what I could do to work around it. And what I did is go to the local grocery store and pick and local liquor store and just get a lot of empty cartons, sort of smallish empty cartons, you know, maybe 18 by 14 by 12, something like that. And I took my debris to the extent that it would fit into a carton. I would put it into a carton. If it didn't fit, I would saw it up into smaller chunks and basically put into cartons, and I got some gift wrap and wrapped those boxes with gift wrap, make them enticing. And then I would, this apartment was on the first floor, and I had a good view of the street. And I would take out one carton at a time and place it next to a brownstone across the street a little bit away where I could watch it through the window. And I would just leave it there and sort of check my window every few moments, and I would see within 10, 15 minutes, it was gone. And I was watching more closely, and I would see every so often a person walk over and spotting what they thought was a package left by someone, and looked in both directions and grabbed it and ran off with my with my garbage. And I kept putting out boxes till it was all gone. So that was my solution to that problem. By the way, today, I think if you left a box out, the bomb squad would come and you're supposed
probably
to see something, you say something.
In today's
so
world,
don't try
they
this at home, kids.
That's right. But for your time, for when that occurred, one of the things you did as a teacher, which I think is great, and I know we're running out of time, but I was so impressed with how when you started teaching at a university, you were teaching calculus, and you decided that as a teacher, you needed to inspire your students, and how you did it was with the game of pool. And I thought,
yeah,
this really would grab, and of course, all, most of your students were males. And so the game of pool is something a lot of them would be interested in because it takes a great deal of skill to play pool well. You have to calculate. You have to do a number of things. And you see the kids that were sitting in the back of the class would suddenly be all up front. Everybody was up front. They wanted to know what you were going to come up with. So you integrated a game into an environment that most of the time the students would just be sort of sleepy-eyed and fall, you know, just go, please, how soon can I get out of this class? They just wanted to pass the class, get a passing grade, but you brought a whole new perspective to it.
Yeah, I gave it relevance. I gave them something that had relevance in their life. I was dealing with with esoteric problems. Really just doesn't mean anything to many mm-hmm. people, unless they're really academically prone. But once something has relevance, people, you'd be surprised. You can teach many people many things if they have the motivation and you do something that's relevant and they can benefit from it. And that's a lot of that is lacking in our school systems. Donna, before we run completely out of time, I want to tell you I really enjoyed the interview with you. For one thing, you clearly got into the book and you got to know it a little bit, and it made it so extremely pleasurable for me. And I have to tell you, some hosts do not do that, and it becomes apparent actually in about the first 3 minutes, and then of course you do your best because you're on the program. But this has been really extremely pleasurable for me. Thank you so much.
Oh, Elliot, it's been a joy. Now, I want my listeners to know, if you'd like to find out more about Elliot Rice, his last name is spelled R-A-I-S, I really think that it gives you perspective into how, through your thinking, you can produce actions that are going to give you momentum in life. Now, you may not want to wrap gift boxes of trash and leave them on the sidewalk like he did when he was younger. They don't want to do that because, like you said, in our world today, the bomb squad would probably be called. But seriously, there are so many points of information that he gives that's so valid. So regardless of what you go through, this is a book that can really inspire you. Stealing the Borders, it's considered warm, witty, and a bit of the outrageous. Go to stealingtheborders.com. Elliot, thank you very much for being my guest today. This is Donna Sebo. We're taking a break. We'll be right back.
Are you concerned about nutrition? Do you work hard to eat right, try to feed yourself and your family nutritious food? Well, you'll want to know about glyconutrients. What are they? These are sugars that are present in nature. However, we're not getting them in our food anymore. Scientific study is proving that these sugars are necessary for all cellular and immune system function. Over 20,000 studies are conducted each year on glycoforms alone. These are the sugar protein structure that line each and every cell of the body. 4 out of the last 8 Nobel Prizes in physiology have been awarded for research in the area of cellular communication and how these sugars work in the body. This is Donna Sebo. Every day I bring to you information that will empower and light up your life. I would like to invite you to visit my website, DelphiInternational.com, and find out more about these glyconutrients. That's DelphiInternational.com. Go to my website, go to the left side of the screen, tap on the button that says glyconutrients. MIT's Technology Review, February 2003, states that glycomics is one of the 10 emerging technologies that will change the world. Education is the key to advancement of understanding and making our lives better. Visit my site, DelphiInternational.com. Go to the left side of the screen and tap on the button that says glyconutrients. I know it'll make a difference for you, as it has for me.
Are you taking too many oral pain pills and concerned about the side effects? Are you having trouble getting to sleep at night because of the pain? Well, I'm Lou Paradise. I had the same problems you have, cured my pain, eliminated pain pills and their side effects by developing Toprasin, pain relief and healing cream. Toprasin relieves pain without the side effects. It doesn't burn, it doesn't smell, and it doesn't stain. But don't take my word for it. Doctors, pharmacists, and pain specialists are using and recommending Toprasin and ending the suffering for thousands of people just like you. We know you hurt. We want to help. We are so sure that Toprasin will work for you, we offer a money-back guarantee. So if you want the pain relief without the side effects, ask for Toprasin. Toprasin is available at Duane Reade, Quick Check Pharmacies, and Wegmans. Ask for Toprasin or call 1-800-959-1007 for a store near you. That's 1-800-959-1007. Toprasin, the last pain medicine you'll ever need, and you can sleep on that.
Hi, this is Donna. I'm so delighted that you've been able to join me today. Give me a buzz if you would like to chat at 888-627-6008. That's 888-627-6008. 888, and all I need from you is your first name or your initial, and of course I'd love to know what part of the country you're calling in from, and let me tell you what I perceive, and then after that you can ask me a question about anything that you like. I wanted to share a thought that Elliot had, and I know we ran out of time in the first portion, but I really think that these words are important. There's no one in life that's not going to go through difficulty, ugliness. And let's face it, if you survived any Holocaust of any kind, I mean, we've had people that have survived. We've got a gentleman who's a gardener, his family survived the Cambodian massacres. You have people like Pol Pot, Idi Amin, Stalin, Hitler. We've had so many just in recent history that have done appalling things. It's going on right now. It's going on right now in the Middle East. Individuals that do appalling things to human beings. And this, when you come out of something like that, or any other situation, there's ugliness in life. Anybody that says it's not there, well, I'm sorry, but you're being a little bit naive. A little bit? How about a whole bunch? The reality is the only way that kind of environment can be put away or put in place is when we have initiative and we take power over our own space and then understand that we have to set a standard that is going to be stronger than the opposite spectrum. This is what Elliot said, and I'm just going to quote verbatim from his book. He said, starting life on a train shapes you. Remember, he was born in 40, so his whole family went through, and that's his story, the complete story is in the book. Even if you get off of that train, if you must be clever or self-reliant to survive, you become so. The urge to survive is strong. Each of us adopts techniques for it. Those techniques may outlive their usefulness, and it's very important. But they do remain with us because that's what we know. They become ingrained in us, staying with us even after we no longer need them. And he said in his case, he had to learn to adapt, to improvise. He learned to contract or grow as the situation required, adjusting himself like the squeeze box that he played as a child. Now, this is something that we all need to keep in mind. Life is not a straight line. I say that over and over again because I know it for a fact. You're going to have your dips, your loops. You're going to have your, whoa, I wonder, and oh my goodness, how come I made such a terrible mistake? And oh, am I ever going to get unstuck from this mud hole that I've been frozen in? You will. You will. But it is that adaptability that is so important. It is that we have as human beings that makes us unique. And so, regardless of what hits us, nobody's going to be exempt from experience. And the idea of trying to protect someone from everything, like our children, is not such a wise thing. Because when they're adults, they're then going to expect that everybody has to take care of them. I know of many adults that have that attitude. They're in their 60s and 70s, some of them, saying, I just don't understand why I can't have this perfect, whatever it is, Cinderella life that they imagine they're supposed to have. It doesn't exist. So adaptability is very important, and we are living in very dynamic, changing times, and that adaptability is something that we must utilize for ourselves. It's so incredibly, incredibly important. So I wanted to share those words of his because I think they are extremely significant. How are you going to work with the circumstances you have? Being mindfully present about where you are and being grateful for what you have in any given moment is very, very important. But being open and receptive for possibilities makes all the difference in the world, too. I wanted to, oh, by the way, give me a buzz at 888-627-6008. I came across a bit of trivia that I was amazed by. One thing, when you do a show like I do, and you have the thousands and thousands of pages of material that are reviewed, because I actually read the material, and I so appreciate my guests' kind comments, but the reason I read it is because I feel that if I don't, how can I talk to someone about what they've done? I need to have material. Well, you never know it all. Not ever. I can tell you there is billion times more information I have no knowledge about than that which I do. And this was a point of information that was new to my little trivia moment. It's about a stamp. Now, stamps, we use them all the time. Do we give much attention to them? Maybe, if we're a stamp collector. But usually, we don't, because they're there. We just take them for granted. They have all these beautiful designs, beautiful patterns, all kinds of wonderful things that are on them. To me, the artwork that's done for stamps is just absolutely spectacular. There was one stamp that almost caused a war. Well, when I came across this information, I was intrigued by it because I thought to myself, a stamp? How could a little itsy-bitsy something like that start a war? And this is what I learned. There was a stamp issued by Nicaragua in 1937. Now, the stamp showed a map of the country, but in showing the map of Nicaragua, it included a large section of land that was claimed by the neighboring state of Honduras, or the country of Honduras. Now, these two countries have been at odds for a lot of years about ownership of the region. And it just had gone on, and it had gone on, and it had gone on. Now, in 1906, King Alfonso the Eighth, King Alfonso the 13th of Spain, he said Honduras was going to get the property. But Nicaragua, you guessed it, they said, that's our land. So, as I mentioned, a lot of tension. When Nicaragua released the stamp in 1937, the people in Honduras were furious. Government officials, newspapers, radio stations demanded that all the stamps be recalled and destroyed. However, the authorities in Nicaragua said, fat chance, this is the truth, and we have the right to label this as territory and litigio. Regardless, anti-Nicaraguan demonstrations erupted in the capital of Honduras, and across the board, Nicaraguan radio announcers called for military action, demanding the National Army be sent to guard the border region. The public even began a donation drive designed to fund more planes. They wanted to build up the Nicaraguan Air Force. Oh, yes, here we go. Well, at the very last minute, three countries intervened. The United States, Costa Rica, and Venezuela. They said, we have got to defuse this conflict before it gets into war. The result of this is that Honduras and Nicaragua agreed to withdraw their armed forces from this disputed area and to demobilize the troops. And there was a peace agreement called for withdrawing the offending stamps. They remained in circulation, though, but supplies eventually ran out. Now, I don't know what the stance is today, but that's what happened in 1937 because of a little stamp. Just shows you sometimes those things that you feel would not make a difference at all can unleash what could be considered a full-scale war. How many times has that happened in history? I imagine a lot of times. Donna Siebel here. Give me a buzz if you'd like to chat. 888-627-6008. Quickly, I want to remind those of you who are in Western Washington, and maybe some of you that want to come up and visit us. There is a phenomenal event that's coming up in August, just around the corner, the Washington Midsummer Renaissance Fair at the Kelly Farm in Bonnie Lake, Washington. And I've had the privilege of being involved in this event for 13, 14 years, and it's marvelous. You step back in time as soon as you go through the gates, and it is just magical. It's a family-oriented event. It's the first three weekends in August, Saturday and Sunday, absolutely great. It's going to be from 10 until 7, and I have free family passes. I have 9 left. I'd love to see you and your family come out, and all you have to do is give me a call at my office, 253-582-5604, or send me an email saying, Donna, I want a pass. send it to Donna@DelphiInternational.com. Either send me an email or give me a call, 253-582-5604, Donna@DelphiInternational.com, and I'll get it off in the mail to you as soon as I can. Check out the information on the event. Go to WashingtonFair.com, and you'll get more detail. It is a phenomenal event. And look for my booth. I have a booth there in the canopy, and there are huge red lions on a bright yellow background. That is my identification for my booth, and you'll see that. Come on by and say hello. I'd love to meet you. Now, by the way, tomorrow we're going to be talking about seaweed. Now, seaweed is a food that many cultures have used as part of their diets for centuries. But why is it so important in today's world? How does the pollution of the ocean affect the nutritional value of seaweed? That and much more we're going to be discussing tomorrow with Scott Kennedy, so I invite you to join me. And we're going to be taking a break for just a moment, and when we come back, again, those phone lines are open at 888-627-6008, and I have a luscious recipe, a teriyaki shrimp salad to share with you, and some other things as well. So don't go away. We'll be right back.
Do you have children between the ages of 3 to 10? Do you love children's books and collect them? Then you'll want to know about God's Kiss, the award-winning illustrated children's book that has been enjoyed by families around the world. 15 beautiful illustrations by Pacific Northwest artist Ed Gedros accompany this lovely story about a little boy named Johnny that will capture your heart and mind in a very special way. Multicultural and non-denominational in content, it will become a family favorite that you and your children will want to read again and again. This book is available by itself through Amazon, or if you contact me, Donna Sebo, directly, you can get a personalized signed copy. There is also a talking book. You can order the talking book CD by contacting me via email, Donna@DelphiInternational.com, or by calling 253-582-5604. You can also visit my website, DelphiInternational.com, to see more details. God's Kiss is a family classic that belongs in everyone's library. Get your copy now. Have you ever had a friend tell you about a product they really believed in? Hi, this is Donna Sebo. Toprosin is a homeopathic cream that is just fabulous. I use it and my friends use it for relief of painful discomfort such as aching muscles and sore feet. Odorless, non-greasy, it is a product that belongs in everyone's medicine cabinet and first aid kit. Check out www.toprosin.com, that's T-O-P-R-I-C-I-N, and find out more information. You can order Toprosin online or call 800-959-1007, that's 800-959-1007. Be sure to give them the code DS30 and you'll receive a 30% discount. Toprosin, non-toxic. Safe for children, too. This is a product that really works. Try it. I think you'll like it.
Hi, this is Donna. Okay, I wanted to share with you this teriyaki shrimp salad. It's summertime, having a different flavor. Raw vegetables are great. I mean, let's be real. It's a good salad. It's so refreshing, especially when it's hot. And if you're like me, you like to try different things. And so having something with an Asian twist to it, I think, is really good because you incorporate so many different, what I want to say, flavors. And it doesn't add a whole bunch of calories. With this salad, if there are certain ingredients in it that you want to change, that's what you do. But here is the way it goes. It's very, very simple. And if you have two packages, about 3 ounces each, of any flavor ramen noodles, these are the ingredients in it. And I would say this. If you are someone that's allergic to gluten, substitute rice noodles. They're fabulous. They are just so easy to fix. You're going to need hot tap water. 5 tablespoons of sesame oil, 5 tablespoons of rice vinegar, 1/4 cup of teriyaki sauce, 1 1/4 pounds of extra large shrimp peeled and deveined. Of course, you can get that at the store. 2 cloves of garlic, and you want to mince that real finely. About 8 ounces of snow peas, and that's about 4 cups worth of snow peas. 1 can of whole baby corn rinsed and drained. 4 radishes. Cut into wedges, about 1/2 cup, and 2 scallions finely chopped, about 1/2 cup there. Now, let me make a suggestion. Use your fresh corn. You don't even have to cook it. Raw fresh corn, it's dependent on how sweet it is when it's been picked. And if it's in your local area, I know here in the Pacific Northwest, fresh corn raw is just absolutely marvelous. But even if you don't want to do it raw, then just blanch it and then add it. But the sweetness of summer corn is just, there's just no equal to it right off of, right out, you know, from picking. It's just wonderful. There's just a delicious flavor. But this is what you do for this salad. You don't want to use the flavoring packets from packages of ramen noodles. Put them aside for some other use if you want. Now, again, you can use rice noodles. Rice noodles really work well. In a large bowl, combine ramen noodles with enough hot water to cover and just let them stand until they soften. It's going to take about 10 minutes, and then you drain, and then they'll cool. Meanwhile, what you can do in another bowl, a big bowl, you want to take your sesame oil, your vinegar, your teriyaki sauce. You want to reserve that, whisk it together. Then you want to take a large nonstick skillet and spray it with some cooking spray. And you want to heat it over medium-high heat. Add your shrimp with the garlic and use stir-stirring until the shrimp are opaque. That's only going to take you 4 or 5 minutes. You remove them from the skillet. And then in the same skillet, you add snow peas and you stir them occasionally until they're just tender. That takes maybe 3 minutes. Then you can add your noodles, shrimp, snow peas, baby corn, your radishes and scallions to the sesame dressing that's in the big bowl. And you toss it until it's well coated. That's how simple this is. And then you move it to a serving platter of choice and you serve it right away. And I myself have been using more and more of rice products because I have found that there is, I can't say it's an allergy to wheat. I'm just noticing that I am feeling better by not taking in wheat. It's just a very subtle thing. That's my choice. But I have found that those rice noodles are really, really good. So if you're on a gluten-free, which a lot of people are in today's world, this might be something that you just keep in mind. If you want to have spaghetti or you want to have anything where normally you would use a pasta, then look at your rice noodles, if that is something that is a comfortable alternative for you. And what I like about them is it doesn't take any time at all to cook them. Just put them in hot water for a few minutes, bingo. Mix it with your favorite sauce. It's terrific. So I share that with you because I really, really think it's a very easy-to-fix recipe. And if you don't like radishes, put in some other items that are going to be just right perfect for your taste buds, whatever it is. Remember, your imagination, use it when it comes to cooking. It can really produce some good things. If you don't like corn, find another vegetable that you can add. Again, just improvise a little bit. I wanted to talk about our immune systems. More and more comments are coming out in publications in medicine, whether it's arthritis or it's heart problems, inflammation being a primary culprit. Well, many times people are not aware that inflammatory conditions in the body can be caused by foods, and it affects your autoimmune system. And that's where I think eventually we're going to reach a point, and I would suspect within the next 15 to 18 years, that they will be able to do an analysis of our body's chemistry and do it on a periodic basis, because as we grow, our bodies change and our environments change and our needs change for nutritional balance. Certain people can eat certain foods that never bothers them. Other people, they're highly, highly sensitive. So bringing all of these components together is going to be a factor of science, and it's going to make a big difference in wellness for millions of people around the world. We're not there yet, but we're getting there. Now, the immune system, if it goes out of whack, it'll literally attack a healthy body if the autoimmune system just does funny things. And penicillin, for example, is something that was life-saving for millions and millions of people many years ago, but it's the most common cause of fatal anaphylaxis. So you have some people that are highly sensitive to this, and they have to be aware of it. And that's something that, again, I think people can be tested for this if necessary. But I was surprised to find out that most food allergies result from an immune response to a protein. And they did, in 2004, an experiment at Trinity College in Dublin with some mice. And they found that they had a way of working with it. Now, what they did, they injected mice with parasites, giving the animal's immune system a threat that the system would fight. And it distracted them from food proteins, so the autoimmune system. The experiment worked, and in 2007, a British entrepreneur, Jasper Lawrence, decided he was going to do something. Now, this was just unbelievable to me, but this is what the guy did. He walked barefoot near some latrines. His aim was to acquire hookworms, which he hoped would defeat his asthma and seasonal allergies. Do you know it worked? Yeah. I mean, that's just unbelievable. Now, this is what he's done. He started a business shipping parasites worldwide. They're not permitted here in the United States. And for $3,000, customers receive up to 35 hookworm larvae. Simply apply the larvae to a bandage, slap it on, and in a few minutes they wiggle through your skin. But nobody's keeping records on the success rate. Ugh. Anyway, it worked for him. He got rid of allergies. Figure. Go figure. I mean, there's just things we just don't know. But there's all kinds of creatures that they're finding that can assist in taking care of things. But on this particular case, I don't think they're keeping good records. This is Donna Sebo. Our hour is up. I'm so delighted you were able to join me today. Remember, always, you're the master of your fate. You are the captain of your soul. Have a magnificent day, and know that you are living your life in its own special magic, and you can make that magic work even without a wand. This is Donna Sebo. Have a magnificent day. We'll be chatting again tomorrow. Bye for now.
You have been listening to The Donna Sebo Show. If you would like a copy of today's broadcast, send $10 to The Donna Sebo Show, P.O. Box 97272, Tacoma, Washington, 98497-0272. Be sure to put the date of the broadcast in your request. If you are not able to be a part of today's program, join Donna and her guests Monday through Friday, and she will be here to take your calls. Thank you for listening and being part of our program. Have a wonderful day.